The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Between World War II and 2011, as many as 100,000 service members were less than honorably discharged for being gay. It was, Dave Phillips writes in the New York Times, a kind of scarlet letter that barred them from any benefits and scarred their civilian lives. Now, 4 years after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay vets are requesting an upgrade to their status. A bill in Congress would restore benefits to nearly all of them, but the bill has been stalled since 2013, and the road to restitution for many discharged veterans has not been easy. Dave Phillips is military correspondent for the New York Times and wrote about the issue. And Dave, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So you talked to several former service members who had been less than honorably discharged or discharged as a Class II homosexual. Now, what did that mean for them?
It essentially means that you're kicked out of the Army or whatever service you serve in. And when that happens, there's a lot of things that can affect you for the rest of your life. The most important of them is that you are then barred from getting veterans' benefits in almost all cases. Health care, help with loans, education benefits, all the things that we as a society have set up to help people transition from the military, they don't get. And for a lot of them, that affected them when they were kicked out when they were younger. But then now, decades later, again, as they maybe start to need care from the VA, affects them again.
And in their personal civilian lives, some of those effects went even more deep. What are some of those cases?
Well, you know what was really striking for me when I began speaking to these folks, some of whom were kicked out in the 50s and early 60s, was that, you know, oftentimes they were growing up in pretty conservative rural places, and they were joining the military not knowing necessarily that they were gay, and a lot of times had their first gay experiences in the military. And so, you know, all of a sudden they're going through this very perplexing self-discovery, and at that point they get essentially prosecuted for it. I mean, they were kicked out. They weren't charged with crimes, but they were shunned. They were sent away. They were often outed by the government to their family and communities, and they had their identity as a young service member stripped from them. And then they went home to areas where oftentimes they were required to show employers their military records, which, you know, said right on them that they had been kicked out for being gay. So it was a really hard thing for a lot of people to get over. And so many I talked to just buried it in various ways and tried to move on and never speak of it again.
Many have passed away in this day and age, but still, how many service members are potentially eligible to get their discharge status upgraded?
We really don't know how many over the decades were kicked out in this way. There are some pretty good estimates that put it at somewhere around 100 to 120,000. You know, it may be more. We just don't know because the record keeping was not very good, and no one has really tried to dig back deep into it.
How has the U.S. military's punishment or treatment of homosexuality changed over the years, you know, going back to the beginning of the Republic?
Well, you know, what's astounding is that homosexual acts have always been barred by the United States military. There are court-martial documents that are signed by General George Washington that show he kicked a young officer out for being gay and literally had him drummed out of the fort, followed by a fife and drum troop. And for generations afterwards, it was treated as a misconduct offense, something that you could be court-martialed for or kicked out of the service for. And then right around World War II, the military changed how it viewed homosexuality and started looking at it instead of as a crime or a misdeed. They started viewing it as almost like an innate defect, something that they could screen for in the same way they screen for flat feet or bad vision and try and keep out of the force. Now, effectively, it was the same thing. If you were gay, you were not allowed to serve. You were often drummed out in very unpleasant ways, but people were no longer court-martialed for it. Instead, they got these quick discharges that would be either undesirable, is what they called it, an undesirable discharge, or a less than honorable discharge. But the effect was the same. They were out of their chosen career, and they were often stripped of their benefits.
And then after the war and the charged environment of the Cold War, how did things change?
There was this idea that started in the Cold War that homosexuals were dangerous to national security, that somehow they could get blackmailed for being gay and give away government secrets. And so starting in the 50s, there was a concerted effort to hunt down and drive out gays from the military. And usually the investigators that took this on, they worked in pairs, and they would identify people and bring them into, you know, a small interrogation room, the type of thing you see in a bad old police movie, and just, you know, give them the good cop, bad cop for a couple hours and threaten them. One veteran I talked to, the investigators had gone through his room and gotten his address book, and they essentially told him, look, confess and name names, or we're going to call everybody here in your address book at work and tell them, you know, that you're gay. And what's amazing to me is that that process really, from my interviews, it seems to have stayed unchanged throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, where, you know, I think in civilian life it would have been seen as inappropriate. But in the military, there was still very much an edict to identify gays and get them out.
I'm speaking with Dave Phillips. He's military correspondent for The New York Times, and he wrote about a number of less than honorably discharged service members who were kicked out for being gay. Now, after Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they are looking for benefits and to reinstate their status. 4 years after the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, will they automatically be granted honorable status?
Any veteran who wants to correct their discharge and get an honorable discharge can essentially send a form into Washington and ask that this be done. And unless there's some underlying other misconduct that the Pentagon identifies, the policy is to upgrade, to give these folks their honorable discharge. But there's a lot of red tape that they have to go through, the process of getting old records so that you can show how you were discharged, the process of getting that approved, can take easily more than a year. And so there has been an effort to say, hey, look, we as a society should just grant a blanket upgrade to all these people, simplify the process, you know, let them get what was due to them. And that proposal, which is in the form of a bill in Congress, is just stuck right now in essentially Congress being Congress. I think that it's seen as sort of a partisan bargaining chip that's not going anywhere anytime soon.
So the bill would, of course, add a lot of veterans to the roles of those who are already due or hoping to get benefits. Any ideas on how much it would cost to add all of these additional service people to the role of those due veterans benefit?
I don't think the issue has even evolved that far. I think that the people that are coming forward now are a relatively small number compared to what we think is out there. I think that the government hasn't made any sort of estimates about how many might come forward and what it might cost. You know, certainly there is some cost involved in it, but there's probably cost involved in keeping the status quo as well.
So of those that you spoke to, what does this restitution of status mean for them?
With the veterans that I talked to, getting their discharge upgraded was not a matter of trying to get benefits. It was more a matter of trying to regain their sense of decency and respect, to demand to the government and society that had done this to them to acknowledge its mistake and to grant them the courtesy of honor that they had never had before. And that is really what astounded me about this, that someone could carry around shame for decades, you know, a very unpleasant, heavy load of shame, and then be able to put it down and ask for respect, I thought was really a moving thing. And I think that's what's motivating a lot of these guys.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us.
Thank you for having me on.
David Phillips, he's a military correspondent for the New York Times, and that's where we found his article, Ousted as Gay, Aging Veterans Are Battling Again for Honorable Discharges. And you'll find a link to read the article for yourself. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. United States veterans are not required to have fought on the front lines. In fact, some of the most important military jobs in our nation's history avoided battle at all costs. This next story comes from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible.
In the 1940s, there were, as there are today, a lot of great art and design schools in New York City. And there were then, as there are today, a lot of young, talented artists and designers at those schools.
But in the 1940s, there was something else that some of those artists and designers had to do first.
That's our own Katie Mingle.
There was a war going on, World War II, and the Army needed artists because, well, they had kind of a crazy idea.
The crazy idea was this. The United States Army would design a deception unit, a unit that would appear to the enemy to be a large armored division. Thousands of soldiers, tanks, trucks, guns. Only this unit would actually be equipped with fake tanks, fake trucks, fake guns, and manned by just a handful of soldiers.
The so-called Ghost Army would impersonate a larger armored division. Rick Beyer has a forthcoming book about all of this and also made a film about it called The Ghost Army.
You want to make it seem like something is there that isn't there. And if you want people to do that, you're going to want artists.
The Army was interested in recruiting people with art, with an art background. We were going to do installations of sorts.
That's Jack Macy.
I was an art major, which is why during World War II, I got picked for the Ghost Army.
So young Jack is shipped off to Europe to join the camouflage unit, where he discovers that a lot of the other guys in his unit are also artists.
A good 50%, we'll say.
And one of the things all of those artists had been working on was designing fake tanks and trucks.
And so that's when I discovered my first inflatable tank.
Inflatable rubber tanks were a crucial part of the visual deception unit.
But the visual deception unit had more than just tanks.
Virtually every kind of vehicle the Army has, the Ghost Army had inflatable versions of.
This stuff was all meant to be believable from a distance, for planes flying overhead or maybe people looking through binoculars. And at a distance, the inflatables were super realistic.
The whole point of the Ghost Army was to make sure their presence was known. The Ghost Army needed to be seen and heard and perceived by the Germans as being real.
Which brings us to the deception unit that I probably would have been drafted into, sonic deception.
So they would record the sounds of tanks going down roads or the sounds of trucks of men reaching a certain point and all the men jumping out, and then be able to play them back in such a way as to make the enemy think that those things are really happening.
The speakers could project sound as far as 15 miles, and there was a huge library of sounds to choose from. For example, engines make different sounds depending on the terrain, and they had all of those different kinds of sounds.
People who heard this say that it was unbelievably eerie, that it was so realistic that you started seeing vehicles that weren't there.
The third component of the Ghost Army were the radio operators. It was well known that the Germans listened in on radio communications of Allied troops. So if the Ghost Army was trying to impersonate a real armored division, they'd have to send the right kinds of transmissions.
All of the units paid incredible attention to detail, but the radio operators had to be perfect mimics. They had to learn the exact keystrokes of an individual Morse code operator in the unit they were impersonating.
And if you don't do that, the German intercept person listening is going to think, well, wait a minute, is that really from the 4th Armored Division?
Over the course of the war, the Ghost Army lost 3 soldiers and had several dozen wounded. But overall, it was one of the safer assignments of World War II.
And the Germans never caught on to the Ghost Army.
Victory by deception.
And that story was produced by Katie Mingle and Roman Mars of 99% Invisible. While members of the Ghost Army may have stayed out of battle whenever possible, there's no question that they fought in a real war. That, sadly, is not the case when we talk about another subset of American veterans, the soldiers of the Cold War. In the eyes of the U.S. government, our nearly 50-year standoff with the Soviet Union was not an actual war, conflict, or even a skirmish. And as producer Eric Malinsky reports, many retired servicemen don't feel like they get the same credit granted to other types of veterans.
Bill Robinson was part of an elite crew, people who had their finger on the button.
I spent a better part of 5 years in SAC, the Strategic Air Command, flying B-52s.
Circling the Arctic for 24 hours at a time.
And I also flew them in Vietnam.
If given the order, he would have nuked Moscow.
We had one purpose and only one purpose, and that was to put our bombs on the target regardless of battle damage, regardless of anything other than complete destruction of the airplane. So we all knew that we were basically flying a suicide mission.
Well, officially they were called Chrome Dome missions. They were tested constantly, rehearsing World War III over and over again.
Every time we had a practice alert, we never actually knew whether it was for real or not. But if it were the real thing, of course, we would have nothing to come back to. In the back of our minds and my mind, I knew that my family would probably be vaporized.
Bill and his crewmates were on the front lines of the Cold War. But when the Soviet Union fell, there were no victory parades, no medal ceremonies. Gorbachev was barely clinging to power. And the first President Bush was worried that if it looked like America was gloating, there might be a backlash in the Soviet Union. Now, Bill Robinson understands that, but he still felt unappreciated.
It would be nice to have somebody say thank you. You know, it would have been nice to have somebody say, well, as my old ops officer said, it was a real bucket of snot, but thanks.
Bill is part of a growing movement of retired servicemen who are supporting the American Cold War Veterans Association. The organization is lobbying Congress to create a Cold War Service Medal. They have the support of 7 senators, but the Pentagon is against it. Here's the problem. The Department of Defense does not consider the Cold War a real war, and they're worried that if they give medals to people who didn't serve in combat, they'll water down the whole meaning of the word veteran.
I'm Scott Lequier.
Scott Lequier believes that he was in a real war,
and
the contribution of his crewmates needs to be recognized.
Sometimes I wonder if President Reagan was still around and conscious of this, would he have recognized us? And I've spoken to Ronald Reagan, actually, on a Christmas day when I was out in a missile site once. He called us and said, Merry Christmas.
Scott spent 4 years as a chief mechanic at a nuclear missile silo. The job was grueling. The missiles were constantly malfunctioning, but the base had to be fully operational in case the Soviets took a first strike. The crew was tested every day, not knowing if it was the real thing. One of Scott's roommates couldn't handle the stress. He was kicked out.
I can't tell you how much that guy did for the mission. He couldn't do the job, but he propped us up so much so he might as well have been the truck that drove us there. And when they kicked him out, it was unbelievable to all of us because, you know, he was like our parent. We didn't realize he couldn't go home because of the family issues, and he hung himself in our room. I have a flag that's on my mantle right now that was flying over the squadron at the time, and I keep it in a box in his memory.
Those memories weigh heavily on Scott. He had trouble adjusting to the outside world, and he describes his experience as being like underground solitary confinement. Scott was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He showed up at a local VA hospital, and that's when he discovered he wasn't technically a veteran because he didn't serve during an official period of war like Vietnam.
I was locked out from being a new applicant because of my service dates weren't during a war period. And I went crazy. And that's when I really got involved.
Scott now recruits members for the American Cold War Veterans Association. He's hoping to change the system, which he thinks is unfair.
Everybody's made hay on the Cold War, from authors to politicians to the media. Everybody for 50 years has made their careers on the Cold War. And it was us that carried out that mission. And the fact that we're forgotten is unbelievable.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have pledged their support, but getting money's going to be tough. A new generation of soldiers is coming home with pressing concerns. The Cold War veterans might have to hunker down for a long fight. The payoff may be years down the road, but they're used to that.
Since that story was produced by Eric Molinsky, a number of bills have been proposed in the House and Senate to create a national Cold War medal. Well, the veterans of that long conflict are still waiting, despite those efforts.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Capturing and sharing images has never been easier. From the streets of Tehran to Jerusalem, citizen and photojournalists give us a look at conflict zones the world over. But during America's Civil War, it took the work of a few intrepid photographers equipped with bulky cameras, tripods, and sheets of film to bring those images home. Among them, a Scotsman named Alexander Gardner. His work is the subject of a retrospective at the National Portrait Gallery. It's called Dark Field of the Republic. Alexander Gardner photographs 1859 to 1872. And the exhibition was curated by the Portrait Gallery's senior historian, David Ward. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks a lot, Virginia. Really happy to be on and talking to you.
So a lot of people may not know the name Alexander Gardner, but what are some of the images that might ring a bell for us?
Well, that's actually one of the interesting things about the exhibition is that we know very little about Alexander Gardner, and he tends to be overshadowed during the Civil War by the big name, which is Matthew Brady. But we do know his pictures. We know his images of Lincoln. He was Lincoln's favorite photographer. He took multiple images of the president, well, even the president-elect in 1861 before Lincoln was inaugurated. He took major pictures of the Union generals. He was based in Washington, D.C., so there's an East Coast bias here. And then what he's really famous for and what the real impact of his work was that he took the camera out of the studio and took it to the battlefields, and he photographed the aftermath of the battles of Antietam and then Gettysburg, 1862 and then in 1863, and created these indelible, harrowing, heartbreaking images of modern industrialized warfare, which really changed first just the discipline of photography, as you said in your introduction. But it also really just changes American culture. It's the way in which America comes of age and America becomes less innocent, less romantic, more realistic, more even cynical.
It is so stunning to see these photographs, you know,
yeah,
twisted, bloated bodies on the battlefield. We would never see these now. That's one thing. They're so affecting. Do you think the Civil War photographers that went out there knew that?
Yeah, I think that this was, well, first of all, I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that Gardner and Brady or Timothy O'Sullivan, they were commercial photographers. They had to make a living. They made a living by selling their images. They weren't fine art photographers. It was a commercial transaction. You could, as an ordinary citizen, go in and buy Gardner's Lincolns or buy his book, The Dead at Antietam. And I think there was an element of photography lends itself to realism, but the camera has become becoming more and more mobile. It's more flexible. The cameras are becoming smaller, lighter, easier to use, and it comes out of nowhere. He's working for Matthew Brady in Washington. It's September 1862, and the Battle of Antietam, he takes his portable darkroom out to, you know, a wagon and loads it up and goes the 100-some miles out to Sharpsburg, Maryland, to the battlefield, and starts to take the pictures of the aftermath. I mean, it says something about how unprepared everyone was, that the battlefield was not cleared of debris and corpses and casualties and dead horses the 3, 4, 5 days after the battlefield. It was still just sort of smoking and festering. The New York Times said when they were displayed in Manhattan, these photographs have a terrible distinctness, that if they have not brought the war into our very houses and streets, they have done something very much like that. Ever since, we have been very careful and cautious in America, in particular, about what we show in terms of casualties, the element of either de facto or official censorship. In World War II, for instance, there was no depiction of American casualties until very late in the war. And this controversy about what you can show and not show, the sensational and frankly disturbing images of dead bodies, is something that we continue to debate and struggle over.
Well, you've opened up so many things, including, mm-hmm. you know, who he was politically. He was a relative newcomer to the U.S.,
right.
Emigrated from Scotland in 1856. Was he neutral? Do you have any ideas?
Well, no, actually, we know a little bit about him. We know, for instance, that he was an abolitionist, that he was on the side of the Union, and he's very sympathetic to the cause. And I think that there was also probably a political impulse, although it's very hard to tease out, that by showing the horror of war, there would be an impulse that let's not do this again.
Well, you mentioned the review from the New York Times earlier. I'm wondering how people saw these images. This is before newspapers were able to print photographs. So did people see them, and what was their reaction?
First of all, they were widely seen, and they were seen in the galleries. They photography, you could reproduce them. They were even reproduced as etchings and lithographs in the newspapers, that a photograph would be turned into something you could print up. And I think, first of all, people were stunned. People are shocked. People had a romantic view of warfare. We had a romantic view of why people fought. There was very much a kind of framework of the novels of Sir Walter Scott and the romance of chivalry, and combat was somehow clean. And then when they see the scenes where you look at, say, Bloody Lane at Antietam, where it's a shallow road in the landscape, and it's just full of corpses. I mean, it's just full of them. They're just piled up. And people were shocked. It's one of the reasons I call the exhibition Dark Fields of the Republic. I wanted to suggest the gravity and the weight and the loss of innocence that Americans experienced, that this is a period of it's a heroic period, but it's also a period of great tragedy. The other thing that occurred to me halfway through doing this exhibition, that we need to remember the sensational appeal of photography as well. And even if this is uncomfortable to us, the way in which there's a kind of fascination with looking at the dead bodies at Antietam, this is something that nobody had ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And it's appealing to the senses in a way that I think, like we slow down to look at a car crash, or we turn on YouTube to look at the hanging of Saddam Hussein, there's an appeal here that we need to recognize and see it as part of, you know, human nature or a particular cultural moment, that they were sensational images, and people, however horrible they were in some ways thrilled by them.
We're talking about the Civil War photography of Alexander Gardner. His work is now the subject of a retrospective at the National Portrait Gallery, and we're speaking with the exhibition's curator and senior historian David Ward. Well, I want to talk a little bit about that sensationalism, because there is a photograph that kind of demonstrates this blurry line between artist and photojournalist in a way. One of his photographs from Gettysburg, a very well-known one, Home of a Rebel Sharpshooter.
Right, yeah.
Now, for those unfamiliar with it, first,
right.
Describe it for us.
First, I should just back off a little bit. 1862 in the Antietam pictures allow Gardner to set up his own shop in Washington. He breaks with Brady, sets up his own photography gallery, and then, of course, the competition is really on between him and Brady. But what he does at Gettysburg, which is really unconscionable, is in trying to find scenes that were appealing and marketable, he gilds the lily. I mean, he goes too far. He takes a corpse, a Confederate casualty out of the burial line and moves it some 75 yards into this rocky part of Devil's Den, an area on the southern part of the battlefield. And he creates this four-photograph tableau about the so-called rebel sharpshooter. So there's home of the rebel sharpshooter and the rebel sharpshooter's last sleep. And he creates this little playlet of the fate in these four photographs of the dead Confederate. And the whole thing is a fiction. The poor boy who was dead is not a sharpshooter. Gardner provides the rifle, which they had picked up after the battlefield. The rifles were picked up very quickly, unlike the corpses. So at the very moment in which photography is arguing that it creates an absolutely truthful picture of photography, which is something photography still argues for, Gardner completely destroys that by manipulating it, you know, the truth, manipulating the story, creating a completely fictitious reality. It's really unconscionable, but it does raise issues that his career raises, which is at the beginning of photography, all these questions appear almost immediately, like what can you show and how far can you go in terms of manipulating the truth?
Well, Gardner was also the favored photographer of Abraham Lincoln. There's a famous photo that just weeks, I guess, before Lincoln's assassination, he looks weary. It's distinguished by the crack. There's a crack that goes along the top of it. But to me, I look at this and I think, oh my God, he was a real person, you know, less so in the portraits, but he takes pictures of Lincoln sitting there in a tent, you know, talking with someone, with other people. You know, this is someone we almost assume is in a costume. So it leads me to kind of ask the question of that kind of consciousness. Do you think that he was conscious that he was a witness to history? Was this all commercially motivated? He was just making money off of these photographs. Was he an artist, to your mind?
I think he did see himself as an artist, and he definitely knew that he was a witness to history. From the commemoration of people who may even not be known, but who were prominent at the time through the Lincoln photographs, through the photographs of the Lincoln conspirators, Booth, and when he moves west, taking pictures of the Great Plains Indians. The crack plate Lincoln, which is what you allude to, which was taken in early February 1865, is interesting because it is a complete accident. Gardner, there was no film. It was a glass plate negative, which had to be elaborately prepared. And by the way, one of the reasons why Gardner is so great, he was very skillful at the preparation of the plate and then the preparation of the solution that would allow the image in the plate to be transferred to paper. But it was a very complicated process. And at some point during that sitting, the plate cracked, probably while he was heating it, and he pulled one print of Lincoln and said, well, that's not any good, and threw the glass plate away. So the Portrait Gallery owns the only crack plate image of Lincoln, and it has this ghostly image where Lincoln is both present to us in all his worn and careworn and etched space. I mean, he's exhausted at this point at the end of the first term. But the other thing is that we know that he's going to die. We know, looking backwards, that he has about 6 weeks to live. And so this is the collision between February 1865, where Lincoln has all these plans of ending the war, freedom in the vote for black men, ending slavery, the whole thing, the package. And none of it's going to happen. And there's this, us looking back, there's this sense of inevitability in which Lincoln is now transferred from being an historical subject of an actual human being into a mythological figure.
David Ward, do you have a favorite Gardner image?
Actually, I do. I mean, the crack plate is a great image, but the image I like of Lincoln, it's the November 8th, 1863 image of Lincoln that was taken just before the Gettysburg Address, and it's a full-face view of Lincoln, which was a little bit unusual. Gardner usually posed Lincoln slightly in profile or at a slant, and it's right before the Gettysburg Address, and I am convinced that Lincoln had that picture taken in Gardner's studio on 7th Street, just around the corner from the Portrait Gallery today. And he saw the pictures of that Gardner had taken of Gettysburg and the casualties in the studio while he was sitting and, you know, and they were fussing around taking the pictures. And I think that looking at those photographs from Gettysburg influenced the way that that Lincoln constructed the Gettysburg Address, that he didn't visit the actual battlefield in July, of course, but he saw secondhand Gardner's images of the corpses and the destruction and the blasted equipment and horses and the landscape all torn up. And that's where Lincoln begins to think about the great phrase at the Gettysburg Address that nothing we do or say here can consecrate this ground any more than those who have died here have already consecrated it. And so it's for us, the living, and to dedicate ourselves to a new birth of freedom. In other words, this sacrifice that's portrayed by Gardner leads to the notion that the war had to be fought for higher stakes, that it had to be fought for freedom, not just for the Union. And so that portrait, which is a tremendously dramatic image of Lincoln, connects with the battlefield pictures and connects with the whole history of the war, and I think it's unbelievable.
Well, David Ward, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Hope your listeners do, too.
Me, too. David Ward is the senior historian at the National Portrait Gallery, which is showing Dark Fields of the Republic, Alexander Gardner photographs from 1859 to 1872. You can get a little preview by looking at some of the photographs online. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening this Veterans Day, and we'd like to close with a piece that originally aired on WFPK as part of the show Kentucky Homefront. This is writer Graham Shelby, who talks about how Vietnam changed his father and what he learned when he went there himself.
When I was growing up, there was this mystery that I wanted to solve. It was about my father. Who he was, where he was, and what had happened to him. I had a few facts. His name was Jimmy. He'd been a soldier. And not long after he married my mother, he went off to a place called Vietnam. And when he came back, he was messed up. That's how my mother described it. She was always vague on exactly what messed up meant. But she said that she had hoped that after I was born, that happened about a year after he came back, that he'd get better. But he didn't. And so she left him, and she took me, and we didn't see Jimmy after that. My mother remarried. Jimmy signed a paper so that her second husband could adopt me and become my dad. That's what happened, and it worked out. But growing up, I always wanted to know more about this guy who had once been my father and who had, as I saw it, at some point, chosen not to be. I had the basic facts, but the facts don't always tell the whole story. You need context to understand them. And that's why, when I was 23, I went to Vietnam. It was not long after I graduated from college, and it was this volunteer trip that was sponsored by a foundation, and our plan initially was to build a playground at this orphanage. But that project had fallen through right after we arrived, and so our group leaders arranged for us to visit some orphanages, just kind of to hang out, really. There was no particular plan. It was kind of like we were celebrities on a goodwill tour, but no one knew who we were. And I thought about just staying home, staying back at the hotel, that first orphanage visit that they arranged for us, but I didn't have anything better to do, so I went. Went with about 20 other American do-gooders who had no particular good to do. And our van pulled up outside this cinder block building just outside the city of Nha Trang. And it was a Catholic orphanage. This priest came out, and he looked about 50 years old and had thick glasses on. He spoke some English, and he assigned each of us in the group our own sort of pint-sized tour guide. And mine was this little boy named Dewey. And Dewey looked about 6. And when he came up to me, his neck arched back like he was looking up at a skyscraper. And I was embarrassed. I didn't even know how to say, you know, hi, what's your name in Vietnamese? But Dewey said something to me, and I just sort of smiled at him and looked over at the priest, and I asked for a translation. The priest said, he says you are very big. No, I said, shook my head, and I crouched down until my eyes were just level with his, actually just a little below his, and I said, no, very small. And the priest translated, and the little boy, his name was Dewey. Dewey chuckled. And Dewey led me into his room. It was a big room, a big sort of spare concrete room. It was full of bunk beds, and Dewey had a top bunk, and he showed it to me, and his mattress was like a mat of woven straw with no blanket or pillow. But he seemed to like showing it to me, like he was proud of it because it was his. "It's nice," I said. I tried to think of something to ask him. I figured maybe he had some sort of bedtime ritual, and it was a Catholic orphanage. Maybe he said prayers. And so I picked him up, and I sat him on the bed and kind of equalized our heights. And I asked the priest to translate and said, "At night, do you pray?" And the priest spoke to him, and I listened for anything that might communicate, like admonition or direction from the priest, but I didn't hear anything like that. And they spoke, and the priest said, "He does, but in the morning." "What do you pray for?" I asked. "Pray for?" the priest asked me. "What do you ask God to do for you or to give you?" Dewey smiled a little at the translated question, and when he answered, he kind of paused as if he were thinking about this for the first time. "He says he prays for his parents who are in heaven. He prays for his sister because he doesn't know where she is. He hopes she will be okay. He prays for God to help him be good that day. And sometimes he prays for a toy or something like that." "Is that all?" I said. "That's all," he said. "He doesn't pray to be adopted, to go home with the family?" The priest said something to Dewey, who answered in a kind of bored kid voice, as if this wasn't a particularly interesting subject. "He said, of course, he would like to have a family to live with, but he knows that most children his age don't get chosen for family. A few, but not many, and if they do get chosen, often it's a family that needs someone to work. So he says he likes here. This is my family now," he said. "This is my family now." I glanced around the room and noticed that most of the kids were smiling. They were thin, but not sickly. A couple of the boys who were goofing around with a ball that somebody from our group had brought. And Dewey kind of seemed to be studying me, and his expression was sort of like, "What do you say, big foreign fella?" And I smiled at him like I had a secret. He made this sort of playful face, and I grabbed him around the waist and planted his belly on my shoulder, and I wrapped my other hand around his calf so he would know that I wasn't going to let him fall. And he giggled, and I walked him outside, and I just spun him around and around until he laughed out loud. "This is my family now." I knew that I wasn't getting a complete picture of Dewey's thoughts or experiences. I knew his feelings about his life, his fate, and his place in the world were or were going to be more complicated than that. But at the same time, he shamed me. All that he'd gone through at 6 years old, and he had just declared that the people there at the orphanage were his family. What right did I have to anxiety or self-pity in comparison to him? After all, I had been, as the priest said, chosen for family. The other kids made a circle around us, and all of them wanted a turn, a ride, like Dewey had gotten. And so I gave them turns, a ride on Foreigner Mountain, spinning and spinning until I was so dizzy I almost fell over. I hoped that Dewey would never wonder if it was somehow his own fault that he'd lost his parents. I hoped that he would never think that he was flawed in some mysterious fundamental way and that their absence was the evidence of this. I wished I had a toy to give him or a playground to build him, but instead I just gave Dewey turn after turn more than anyone else, and I spun him longer than anyone else. I wanted Dewey, just this one time, in this one little way, to feel chosen. Thank you.
And that story originally aired on WFPK in Louisville as part of the show Kentucky Homefront. We're so glad you could join us on this Veterans Day. And if you do have a veteran in the family or a friend who maybe you haven't spoken to in a while or know someone who served that you see at the coffee shop every day, maybe it's time to reach out, make a phone call, maybe go beyond thanking them for their service and start a conversation. After all, a smile and a handshake are great, but the more meaningful stuff comes from word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Thank you. I mean...